Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Bhutang dhammang sanghang namassami. Now this particular sutta has been very popular with some monks, because there is a few passages in it which are very complicated Pali and sometimes are open to many interpretations. And because that is open to many interpretations, many monks have employed it to try and squeeze out some other understandings of what the Buddha taught. And when we were discussing, I had a good fortune to discuss this sutta with Venerable Nyanaponika many years ago. He's one of the great monks. He was the one who did a lot of work on these suttas. He was Bhikkhu Bodhi's teacher, and Bhikkhu Bodhi was looking after him, and we're discussing this one. And Venerable Nyanaponika, this ancient German monk who passed away about 10 years ago or 15 years ago, he made this wonderful statement, which I'll always keep in mind. He said, "You cannot interpret the whole of the Buddha's teachings in light of one or two ambiguous passages. You have to interpret the ambiguous passages in light of the whole mass of other teachings which are clear." So it's a very wonderful statement, if you understand what I mean here, what Venerable Nyanaponika meant. There are one or two ambiguous passages. So you can take them, and then from there you can interpret the rest of all the Buddha taught, the Eightfold Path, Dependent Origination, Four Noble Truths. But he said, that's not the way you should do things. Get the mass of teachings, which are very clear, unambiguous, and use those to interpret anything which is ambiguous. And this is the approach which I've always kept ever since hearing that great advice. And the main part of it is when we start talking about perceptions and proliferation, and sometimes people thinking because of this particular highlighted part of the Dhamma that the path to liberation is all about just changing the way you think about life, the way you perceive life, rather than going deeper and actually understanding how you can change things by not just thinking, not by intellectualizing, but by practicing things like precepts and meditation and gaining the insights which happen not when reading books and thinking, but the insights which come when you're sitting quietly on your meditation stool, cushion or chair and get into very deep, still states of mind. So that's a little intro to this sutta. So where we can start it now. I should also say in those days that there was a great deal of freedom of religion in India at that time, as we can probably see as we read through the prologue of this sutta. And that freedom of religion meant that you could say things, you could debate things, you could argue. There wasn't like an authority which said, this is the teachings, you better agree with this, or else you get put in jail, flogged, burnt at a stake, excommunicated. Those sorts of things never occurred in the time of the Buddha. There was this great sense of a freedom of intellectual debate, inquiry, arguments, where everybody was expected to join in, and by that, what you might call level playing field, where everybody's views were given respect, we were hoping that we could get to a deeper sense of truth. And this is actually what's happening here. Debate was not stifled in the time of the Buddha, and hopefully it's never stifled since in Buddhism. You can always argue and disagree with the holiest of monks. Ordinance. So here we go. Thus have I heard. On one occasion, the Blessed One was living in the Sakyam country at Kapilavastu in Nigrodha's park. So that's his home territory, just a little bit away from where he was born, or where he grew up, rather. Then, when it was morning, the Blessed One, that means the Buddha, dressed and taking his bowl and outer robe, went into Kapilavastu for alms, just like we have our bowls these days. The Buddha had his bowl in those days, and going on alms round. When he had wandered for alms in Kapilavastu and had returned from his alms round, after his meal, he went to the great wood for the day's abiding. It was a great forest which existed in those days. Entering the great wood, he sat down at the root of a bilva sapling for the day's abiding. Dandapani, the Sakyan, while walking and wandering for exercise, also went to the great wood, and when he had entered the great wood, he went to that bilva sapling where the Blessed One was, and exchanged greetings with him. When his courteous and amiable talk was finished, he stood at one side, leaning on his stick. That's what Dandapani means, like a stick in hand. Leaning on his stick, and asked the Blessed One, and I know this sutta very well, he wouldn't be asking this Blessed One or the Buddha in a respectful tone. He would be in a challenging tone, leaning on his stick. What does the recluse assert? What do you proclaim? So Dandapani is searching for an argument. And the Buddha completely undermines this by saying, "Friend, I assert and proclaim such a teaching that one does not quarrel with anyone in the world." And then it goes on to the list of beings in the world. "With its gods, Maras, its Brahmas, in its generation, with its recluses and Brahmas, its princes and people." He said, "My teaching, you can't quarrel with." And then he says something about the teaching, and here we go. "Such a teaching that perceptions no more underlie that Brahmin who abides detached from the five senses, without perplexity, shorn of remorse, free from craving for any kind of being." Now, if I said that to you and you hadn't read this before, what would you think? That's a bit strange. What does it mean? And that's actually what Dandapani wasn't very impressed. So when this was said, Dandapani, also a Sakyan, shook his head, wagged his tongue, and raised his eyebrows until his forehead was puckered in three lines. Then he departed, leaning on his stick. And that meant that he wasn't impressed at all. So that was a little exchange there. Sometimes that when people of another religion come up to you and they want to discuss with you, sometimes it is a worthwhile thing to do, to enter into a discussion. But sometimes the best thing to do is actually to get rid of them. And the Buddha quite effectively got rid of him by confounding him. Now, there was a great story, I mentioned this the other day to somebody, that in Brickfields Temple in Kuala Lumpur many years ago, there was many, many famous Sri Lankan monks who are now well known, people like Venerable Gunaratana, Kesari Dhammananda, Venerable Narada Thera, and also this you might call it eccentric Sri Lankan monk, Venerable Ananda Mangala. He did visit Perth many times in the first years I was here. He was a very sort of fascinating monk, but anyway, very down to earth. And they were in this Buddhist temple in Kuala Lumpur, just having a cup of tea together, when these couple of born-again Christians came in to try and convert a lot of them. And instead of actually just having a civilized argument about the merits of their religions, Ananda Mangala just looked at them and said, "Get out of here, you bloody fools." At which the other monks were shocked. But these two Christians were also shocked and just walked out. And he said, "That's the way to do it." Not wasting any time. But it's completely disrespectful, but people said that worked. So anyhow, that's Ananda Mangala. He was really sort of a bit over the top sometimes, but very wonderful to be around. But anyway, this is sort of thing which the Buddha just did. He didn't actually call him a bloody fool, but he just said, you know, something which made no sense to this guy, so the guy just went away. So he departed, raised his eyebrows, and his forehead was puckered in three lines. He departed leaning on his stick. Then when it was evening, the Blessed One rose from meditation, went to Nigrodha's park, that's the monastery, where he sat down on the seat made ready for him, and he told the monks what had taken place. And a certain monk asked the Blessed One, "But Venerable Sir, what is this teaching that the Blessed One asserts, whereby one does not quarrel with anyone in this world, with its gods, Maras, Brahmas, the generation of its recluse of Brahmas, its princes and peoples? What is this teaching? And Venerable Sir, how is it that perceptions no more underlie that Brahmin who abides detached from sensual pleasures, without perplexity, shorn of worry, free from craving for any kind of being?" And this is how the Buddha answers it. "Monks, as to the source through which perceptions and notions tinged by mental proliferation, beset a man. If nothing is found there to delight in, welcome and a hold on to, this is the end of the underlying tendency to lust, of the underlying tendency to ill will or aversion, the underlying tendency to wrong views, of the underlying tendency to doubt, the underlying tendency to conceit, the underlying tendency to desire for being, of the underlying tendency to ignorant. This is the end of resorting to rods and weapons, of quarrels, brawls, disputes, recrimination, malice, and false speech. Here these evil unwholesome states cease without remainder. And that's what he said, and that is what the Blessed One said. Having said this, the Sublime One rose from his seat and went into his dwelling. Now just, I'm not explaining this yet, because it will spoil everything, because as you see, the Buddha said this, and still the monks never understood what he was talking about. Then soon after the Blessed One had gone, the bhikkhus considered, "Now, friends, the Blessed One has risen from his seat and gone into his dwelling after giving a summary in brief, without expanding the detailed meaning. Now who will expound this in detail?" In other words, they still didn't understand. So sometimes people are like that. You know, sometimes when I give a talk, you ask, are there any questions? And everyone is silent. And only afterwards they come up in a big line afterwards and say, we didn't understand this point, we didn't understand that point. So even in the time of the Buddha, sometimes people were overly respectful. And because of that, they never took the opportunity to say, we don't understand what you said. And sometimes making that sort of question, "Venerable Sir, we don't understand a word of what you said." Sometimes you think that's an admission of stupidity that probably everybody else understood. But you'd be probably accurate to say, if you don't understand, no one else understands either. So you'd be doing everyone a favor to say, what you just said was stupid, it don't make sense, Ajahn Brahm, can you please explain yourself further? However, they don't do this. So, they thought, the Buddha has gone into his dwelling, into his hut. Now, who will expound this in detail? Then they consider the Venerable Mahakachana is praised by the teacher and esteemed by his wise companions in the holy life. He is capable of expounding the detailed meaning. Suppose we went to him and asked him the meaning of this. Then the monks went to the Venerable Mahakachana and exchanged greetings with him. When his courteous and amiable talk was finished, they sat down to one side and told him what had taken place, adding, "Let the Venerable Mahakachana expound it to us, please." Then Venerable Mahakachana replied, this is standard, "Friends, it is as though a man needing heartwood, seeking heartwood, wandering in search of heartwood, thought that heartwood should be sought for among the branches and leaves of a great tree standing possessed of heartwood, after he had passed over the root and the trunk. And so it is with you, Venerable Sirs, that you think that I should be asked about the meaning of this, after you pass the Blessed One by when you are face to face with the teacher. For knowing the Blessed One knows, seeing he sees, he is vision, he is knowledge, he is the Dhamma, he is the Holy One. He is the sayer, the proclaimer, the elucidator of meaning, the giver of the deathless, the Lord of the Dhamma, the Tathagata. That was the time when you should have asked the Blessed One the meaning. As he told you, so you should have remembered it." So he's just admonishing them for not asking when the Buddha was there. And they said, "Surely, friend Kachana, knowing the Blessed One knows, da da da." But the Venerable Mahakachana is capable of expanding the meaning of this summary given in brief by the Blessed One, without the Venerable Mahakachana expound it without finding it troublesome. So having admonished them, and they say, "Yeah, we know, but please help." He said, "Okay, paragraph 14. Then listen, friends, and attend closely to what I shall say." "Yes, friend," the Blessed Bhikkhus replied, and the Venerable Mahakachana said this. So this is the explanation of the saying, according to Mahakachana, and then afterwards we actually go back and to see how this relates to what the Buddha said. Paragraph 15. "Friends, when the Blessed One rose from his seat and went into his dwelling, after giving a summary in brief without expanding detailed meaning, that is, quote, Bhikkhus, as to the source through which perceptions and notions tinged by mental proliferation beset a man, if nothing is found there to delight in, welcome and hold to, this is the end of the underlying tendency to lust, the underlying tendency to aversion, the underlying tendency, I say wrong views here because ditti always means the wrong views, doesn't mean the right view, number one of the Eightfold Path, of the underlying tendency to doubt, the underlying tendency to conceit, underlying tendency to desire for being, the underlying tendency to ignorant. This is the end of the resorting to rods and weapons of quarrels, brawls, disputes, recrimination, malice, and false speech. Here these unwholesome states cease without remainder. That's what the Buddha said. I understand the detailed meaning of it to be as follows. Now he said, this is the Mahakachana's analysis through the operation of the senses, how the senses work, the sixth sense basis. And he's actually showing just actually how things occur. Dependent on the eye and forms, in other words, things to see, eye consciousness arises. So the eye consciousness only arises when the eye is intact. It's not just the eye, the whole sense of sight is intact and is something to see. For example, if you're in a black, darkened room, you may have a good eye, fully operational sight, but of course eye consciousness will not be turned on because there's no object to see. Or if you're blind and live in the brightness of day, again, you won't be able to see. Eye consciousness will not be turned on. Eye consciousness is only turned on, the switch is flicked, and there's eye consciousness, only when there is the sense of sight and something to see. Obvious, isn't it? However, later on, this explanation brings up something which is quite controversial, which is why I paid attention to that. The meeting of the three is contact. Consciousness, sense of sight, object of sight, three come together is contact. This is like not just consciousness turning on, this is the experience happening. With contact as a condition, there is feeling. Once is the experience, a part of that experience is also what we call the quality of pleasure, pain, or in between, associated with every sensory experience. So you get the three things come together, that turns on the experience as an experience now, and every experience has a quality of delight, pain, if you like, or in between. And in English, every sense base, seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, touching, mind, the six sense bases, we have a different word for the pleasurable feeling and the unpleasurable feeling. So in sight, we say it's beautiful or it's ugly. In hearing, it's like sometimes we say melodious, if it's a beautiful sound, or a sweet sound, sometimes. And sometimes like a grating sound, or just a loud sound, painfully loud. We have words which are specific to the sense of hearing, which says it's delightful or painful, or things which are not pleasurable. Smell, we have like fragrant, we have stinky, taste, you know, we have delicious, we have like bitter, say. And we have most of our words are for the physical sense, the sense of touch. We have like pleasure and just pain. And also with the mind. That's also a sense. And so we have, you know, the delight, joy, and the painful experiences. We have like depression, anxiety. Depending on what particular painful feeling we're experiencing in our mind, we have a different word for it. In Buddhism, all the painful experiences, the unpleasant experiences of the six senses are called dukkha feeling. All the pleasurable ones of all the six senses are called sukha, happy feeling. Sukha vedana and dukkha vedana. So they have one word which encompasses all the delightful feelings of the six senses, and one word which encompasses all the unpleasant feelings of the six senses. And the Buddha also recognizes there is sometimes it's hard to define, and people argue with it. There's a little bit in between. When you're seeing something, it's not particularly ugly, not particularly beautiful, it's just neither pleasurable nor painful. Now there are some tastes, some sounds, some smells, some physical sensations, or even some mental experiences. You can't say they're delightful, you can't say they're undelightful, they're just ordinary. And so the Buddha in this categorization of feelings has something in the middle. It says neither painful nor pleasurable in between. So these are the three feelings associated with every one of the sense bases. And even the English word feeling, it can sometimes confuse people. It's not a feeling in the sense of a physical touch. And it's not a feeling in the sense of an emotion. It's a completely different word. However, we do not have an English equivalent for this concept in Buddhism of Vedana. That's why I've paused to explain it in detail. Vedana is this quality in every sensory experience. It's delightful, pleasurable, or it's painful, unpleasant, or it's somewhere in between. Now, questions, yeah? It's again, it still confuses people. Okay, now you're saying that, first of all, the first question I should repeat for the tape is saying, is a Vedana a good word for that, the affective part of the experience? It could be, but the affective part is not used commonly enough to really make it usable as a word to describe the Vedana. It's been used as feeling for so often, we have to keep using that word as a feeling, but with an explanation added to it. And is that feeling a separate part of consciousness? And the answer is it's not. It's just part of that conscious experience. It's the same as, is your the color of your hair different from the length of your hair? That's not such a good, the heat of a flame, the light of the flame. Are those different? These are just aspects of one of the same experience. So it's not separate. Consciousness, always part of conscious experience, is the feeling. It's not separate from it. It's just like the color of a flower, the scent of a flower, the shape of a flower. It's all part of a flower. It's just an aspect of it. Maybe when we finish with the six senses, if you'd like to ask that question again, because then actually it will fit in to the flow of what we're trying to explain it. It's going on too fast a tangent, so I don't want to go on that yet, but I don't want to avoid your question. Please ask it at the end of the six senses analysis. But at the moment, I just want to get into people's mind what we mean by feeling. It's actually part of consciousness. It's not consciousness and feeling is something added on afterwards. And it's contradictory. It's not the feeling, is not sort of part of mind consciousness, the pleasure or the pain. It's part of the eye consciousness, the ear consciousness. That's actually an inherent part of that conscious experience. I think any psychologist would know that. Even before you think of it, if you have a painful feeling in the body, you flinch. It's unconscious. It's an automatic response. But the senses actually look away, automatically. It's an automatic response, a reflex action. So it shows that because of the reflex action, nothing to do with you considering and ordering this to happen. It is just a natural part of the sense of seeing, independent of all the other senses, to have a quality of pleasure or pain. Or to put it in English, beauty is in the eye of the beholder, not in the mind of the beholder. Okay. So, here we go. Now, there is a feeling. What one feels, that one perceives. Remember, what we're talking about feeling here is not what we're experiencing. What one experiences with the sense of delight, of pleasure or pain. And what one perceives, that one thinks about. So when there's a pleasure or pain, you've, the beauty and ugly, once you have that perception, then one, the mind works on it, is the right word, not so much thinks about it. And what one the mind works on, one mentally proliferates. With what one has mentally proliferated as a source, perceptions and notions tinged by mental proliferation beset a man with respect to the past, future, and present forms cognizable by the eye. Now, because this is going to be pretty much repeated afterwards, I'm going to just stay on this one to explain it a bit more fully. It is true that when one has pleasure and pain, or in between, you're perceiving that. When you perceive about it, your mind goes onto that, and you can. It's not always the case, but usually people proliferate about that. So you see a beautiful girl. Wow, she's nice, if you're a guy. And you proliferate about that, as many guys do. With what one has many proliferated as a source, perceptions and notions tinged by mental proliferation can beset a person. If they didn't beset a person, there would be no need for supermodels, glossy magazines, with beautiful pictures on the cover. But it's not just a beautiful sights, sometimes the ugly sights which you see. I was just this morning talking with someone that we have one of our members is in hospital, and they said as soon as their father goes into hospital, he's an Italian, he said Italians are just really no good with death. As soon as he went into the hospital, he fainted. He was perfectly okay, it was his daughter was dying. But he was just so afraid and so tense up with the sight of hospitals and people sick and dying that negative sight, you know, caused unpleasant feeling. And the unpleasant feeling he perceived and what he perceived and thought about, he mentally proliferated to the point of fainting. So you can see even unpleasant sights people can proliferate about and make much more of them than what's there. That's what proliferation means, building upon them. And they say making mountains out of molehills, making much, much more than what's truly there. Just the example of death. What's wrong with death? It's just death, that's all. People die. They cark it. They kick the bucket. But what's the big deal? Why do people proliferate about that? It's just dead, that's all. But however, we perceive that, and it's unpleasant for most people, unless that's your grandfather, he's left you a lot of money in the will. But if it's not a case like that, it's unpleasant, and we proliferate about it. We make much more. Oh, I'm not going. How can I live without her? What am I going to do? Life is not no meaning anymore. And that's proliferation. Of course, you're going to live when they're gone. Life still will have meaning after they've gone. So, you know, you're going overboard with your proliferation. But some people do this, they proliferate. Simply because of negative sights, pleasant sights. You don't normally proliferate about boring sights. Except sometimes it might be a movie. It was a really boring movie. Nothing was really happening. Why did I sort of pay my money for that? Because nothing was happening. So maybe in different feelings, maybe you can proliferate on that if you really want to. So because they proliferate on those things, they, as a source, perception and notions tinged by mental proliferation beset a person with respect to the past, the future, and the present forms cognizable through the eye. As again, here the Buddha starts to introduce that what we're seeing right now, again, we proliferate about, you know, building up what happened in the past, all the bad memories of the past, the beautiful sights of the past, and also you proliferate that onto the future, of what you see. And this is continued with all the other six senses. So dependent on the ear and sounds, on the nose and odors, tongue and flavors, body and tangibles, and we, because of space here, in the suttas, they're always abbreviating. Obviously, when the Buddha was saying this, or when Mahakachana was saying this, it would be, every part would be said, which meant that the whole method was reinforced about these two things coming together and turning on the corresponding form of consciousness, and then from the consciousness turning on. There is the feeling, and from the feeling, the perception, from the perception, the thinking, from the thinking, the proliferation, and all the problems came in. Unfortunately, because of trying to save paper, there is sometimes too much abbreviation in the suttas, and the whole teaching method of repeating the message again and again and again is lost. But nevertheless, I think you've got the message here. Let's do it again with the last of the six senses, mind and mind objects. This is on page 204. Depending on the mind and mind objects, mind consciousness arises. I'm going to pause there. What is mind and mind objects? Something to know. Then mind consciousness turns on. Okay, if there's no mind, in other words, you're dead, or you're pavinibbana, or you're unconscious, there might be mind objects, but consciousness can't turn on. Or more importantly, if there's nothing to know, then mind consciousness doesn't occur. I always mention this because the mind consciousness is not always there, just waiting to know something. Just like a box which is always there waiting for someone to put something into it. Mind consciousness only exists. It's just turned on, the switch is flicked when there's something to know. Otherwise, it just does not exist. I mention that because many people have an understanding that mind consciousness is permanent, the ground of all being, the eternal mind, the original mind, and all these ideas where people think there must be some original, continuous form of consciousness. Now, to go back to Daniel's question on the fruit salad simile, which I proposed. Once a person knows what mind consciousness truly is, and the only way to know what mind consciousness is to isolate it from the other five types of consciousnesses. And you do that through the deep meditations known as the jhanas, where you just have mind consciousness. You cannot see, you can't hear, you can't smell, taste, you can't feel your body. Even if somebody punched you, you would not feel it. You are not unconscious, you're fully conscious, fully aware, but only of that sixth sense, the mind. Once a person understands through experience, not through thinking or proliferating, you know, what a mind is, but they know it from raw experience, then when you come out of that experience, you can recognize how this flow of many different consciousnesses happens. What happens is when we see something, most of the time when we see something, then the mind comes in. The next moment, I know I've just seen you. When we hear something, we hear a sound, then the mind, consciousness, jumps in afterwards, and it knows you've just heard a sound. Smells, tastes, and touches are the same. And even, and most interesting, you know something, and then you know you just knew something. The mind consciousness follows the previous mind consciousness. Which answers a question which has troubled many philosophers, which is called self-awareness. Because we know that we know. However, that statement has a slight error in it. When a person says, I know that I know, that confounds many people who are thinkers. However, if we observe that process and describe it accurately, it was much better to say, I know that I knew. When you add that momentary time lapse into that whole process, I know, and then I know I just knew. That is self-awareness. You're aware that you knew a moment ago. And that's what people take to be self-awareness. Once you add that process, the time process into it, the whole illusion unravels. And what you see is, yeah, you see something, and then you know you saw something. You hear something, then you know you hear something. You feel something in the body, and then you know you felt something in the body. So these moments of mind consciousness follow after all the other consciousnesses. And they give every one of these senses an appearance of sameness. Isn't there something similar with seeing and tasting and feeling in the body and hearing? What is it that is similar in all those sensory experiences, even though they're totally different senses? Why do some people think there's something similar when I see, when I hear, when I taste, smell, when I touch? What is similar? What is similar is the fact that this mind consciousness comes in afterwards. So actually what's happening in the fruit salad simile? I gave a simile like seeing being an apple. I tried to get something, some appropriate fruit for each sight, sense. And I used apple because apple of your eye. So an apple is when you see something. So ear, instead of a fruit, I use cauliflower. Because sometimes you get punched, you're supposed to get cauliflower ear. If it's a nose, banana. For this reason. If it's taste, I use the mango because I like mangoes, they taste nice. And if it's feeling, what do I use for feeling? I think I forget now anyway. What's a nice fruit for feeling? What do I use for feeling in my book? I forget now, but anyway, it's an orange. And for knowing, now coconut, because it's like a big head. So those are the fruits or the vegetables similar, which are representing the six senses. Apple for the eye, cauliflower for the ear, banana for your nose, mango for the taste, orange for the body, for the touch, and coconut for the mind. And what actually happens is that you've got a plate, and now you've got an apple, and as soon as the apple is there, straight afterwards a coconut comes in. And then the coconut disappears, and then there's an orange, physical feeling. And then that coconut comes in again. You know you just thought. And then there's another orange, another physical feeling, then another coconut. And then there's another sort of nose, you're smelling something, and then another coconut. I use that simile to try and make the point that in sensory consciousness, it's not a continuous flow of consciousness experience. It appears that way because we don't see it happening fast enough. What's really happening? Sight, mind, consciousness. Another sight, another mind. Sight, mind, sight, mind, sight, mind. Hearing, mind, hearing, mind. Touch, mind, touch, mind. But mind always comes afterwards, which gives it the appearance of sameness, which gives us an illusion of the continuity of consciousness and the sameness of consciousness. That was the fruit salad simile. Yes, Daniel. Okay. Like, it's very, you're asking about the way that mind consciousness turns on and the causes of mind consciousness, just the mind and the, objects of mind. And we already have some of the objects of mind are the borrowed objects from the five senses. Those are the most common objects of mind. In other words, we know what we've just seen. We know what we have felt. Those are the most common mind objects for us. We also, mind has got its own individual series, types of objects. And some of those objects are like, what's it like, fear? Or like, even things like happiness is a mind object. And that's why you've heard me before do a little party trick, only to be used in monk parties or temple parties. When you ask people in a talk, put your hand up, your right hand up if you're feeling happy, your left hand up if you're not feeling happy. One of the two. And they put their hands up and say, okay, those of you with your right hand up, you're feeling happy. Now, with your index finger, please point to that happiness for me. And they wave their hand around and they can't point to that happiness. Or you say, if you're anxious or if you're afraid, please point to that fear. If you're in love, please locate that. What part of your body is in love? And the thing is, you cannot point to those things because they don't exist in their body. They are mind objects. And once you know what mind objects are, then you get some better idea of what mind is. In the same way, once you know what a tree is, what a flower is, what a bush is, then you have a better idea to know what a garden is. What is a garden? A garden is made up by its objects. A mind is made up by its objects. So once you know what mental objects are, then you know what a mind is. Just like a garden is a place where trees, bushes, and flowers live. A mind is where fear, anxiety, love, compassion, anger, where all those things live. These are like the plants which make up the mind. So that's actually how you know what this mind actually is, which is why you can't point to these things like anxiety or fear. Sometimes you can point to some physical manifestation of those emotions, but that's not that emotion. That's just how the body reacts to those emotions. Now, it's an important thing to understand that, because then you understand the mind is not in the body. The mind is not a body thing. It's got its own territory. So that's the mind objects. And that's also understand what the mind is. And you do need those two to come together, to turn on this mind consciousness, the jitter. Other than that, this simile is powerful, because it completely undermines even some monks who say the citta is permanent, the mind is always there. And it also really makes a lot of people very scared. If that's all my mind is, totally conditioned causes, it means one of those causes is not there. Your mind stops. You are not the one who knows. Who am I then? Nothing left to be. Okay, yeah. Is it? Okay, you say mind objects are flavors in the mind, complexions of the mind. But I just chuckle to myself because you're using language from the other senses. Flavors is taste. Complexion is sight. And we do this because the Western world has got such a paucity of language to describe the world of the mind. We have to borrow language from the other senses to describe the world of the mind to ourselves. And you just did that. And that's why I chuckled. And it's common. Okay, a thought, again, is another object of mind. It's a mind consciousness. The thought, you say, where is that thought? You may just had that particular thought of asking this question. Where did that exist? Was it in your head, in your nose? Of course you can't sort of say where it is. It exists in the mind. It is part of the mind. There can be ideas, there can be thoughts. The realm of mind is huge. And we don't explore it. We explore the objects of the five senses rather than the objects of the mind and the nature of the mind. That's why when you get into some deep meditation, you get to some weird places you've never been there before. These things you've never seen before. It's like, you know, people coming across these old explorers who went into the darkest of jungles and they found these animals, these weird animals which no one had ever seen before. And they sort of started calling them. You know, the Perrier's hippopotamus or something. and you gave it your name and became famous because, you know, you discovered a new species. There's a whole new species of things which exist in the mind, which you discover when you go into deep meditations. Enormous amount of stuff in there. So that's why that many people are just so much into the world, don't understand what's happening inside the mind. Because we never go there, we're just too concerned and caught up with what happens outside in the five senses. No, because the two coexist. The Buddha gave a great simile of like the two sheaves. He did ask, this is for the tape, can mind objects and mind exist independent of one another? So that the two sheaves, mind objects, leaning against each other, if you take one away, the other one falls down. You can't have one without the other, in other words. It makes no sense. Now to have, say, a face, you know, without sort of skin or bones, or to have something with weight but no shape. These are just aspects of the same, of one thing. And they always have to have one and the other. Nama Rupa and consciousness. That's right, yes, without an object. Nama Rupa is not just the nama, is an objects of mind. And rupa is just the physical world, the objects of the other five senses, basically. And you need the objects of the five senses. And you see, he's heard a sound, his ears were turned on, and he had that experience of his baby cry. He moved, yes, because the perception's tinted by mental proliferation, because he's the father and you're not, sort of made him get up and go. But where was I? Yeah, it is true, the consciousness and the nama rupa. So that consciousness, that vijnana, in that context, is all those six consciousnesses. And the nama rupa is the objects of mind, is the nama, and the rupa is the objects of the other five senses. Those are the two sheaves in me. That's right. If you know something, fine. But it's not knowing. It's not that you're just idling in, it was in neutral gear. You're just not in gear at all. Disappeared, yeah. Yes. Well, in meditation, the object of mind consciousness is the bliss in the deep meditations. There's different types of happiness. So that is why that, say, in a first jhana, the object of your mind consciousness is just bliss, joy. That's the only way to describe it. And it's a particular type of happiness. Afterwards, analyzing it, it's a particular type of happiness which occurs when your five senses disappear. It does keep that mind consciousness existing. But the thing with the jhana experience is that at such a still state that it tends to stop and fade away. Which means that the mind objects fade away. That bliss fades away and you're very still, and you get the, instead of the happiness of senses disappearing, which is impermanent, then you get the happiness of stillness fills the mind, and that's impermanent. And so that fades away, and then you get fades away slowly, stage by stage, into the third jhana, where the particular type of happiness disappears, the pity part, and then everything fades away in the fourth jhana. You just got pure equanimity. It fades away. And sometimes from that fourth jhana, you can get into this asanya state, which is you're not perceiving at all anymore. When there's nothing to see, the mind stops. There's a particular state in the fourth jhana, the Asanya state. However, that's going way beyond this sutta. And if I keep going on this track, we'll be here till Maitreya comes. So where do we go? Okay. So what one perceives, that one thinks about, one thinks about, one mentally proliferates. With what one has mentally proliferated as a source, perceptions and notions, tinged by that mental proliferation, beset a man with respect to the past, future, and present, mind objects cognizable through the mind. When there is the I, form and consciousness, okay, number 17, when there is an I and a form and I consciousness, in other words, it's a visual experience, it is possible to point out the manifestation of experience, of contact here. When there is a manifestation of this experience, it is possible to point out the manifestation of a feeling. You can actually see it. When there is manifestation of feeling, it is possible to point out the manifestation of perception. When there is a manifestation of perception, it is possible to point out the manifestation of thinking. When there is manifestation of thinking, it is possible to point out the manifestation of being. Or being perceived by perceptions and notions tinged by mental proliferation. So it's like you can see these things. But when there is no I, no form, and no I consciousness, it's impossible to point out the manifestation of contact. Manifestation, when there's no manifestation of contact, it's impossible to point out manifestation of feeling, and therefore impossible to point out manifestation of perception. Impossible then to point out the manifestation of thinking. Impossible then to point out the manifestation of being beset by perceptions and notions tinged by mental proliferation. Same with no ear consciousness. No other senses. And he says, so when all these things disappear, then of course there is no proliferation, no perceptions, no thinking, nothing. Friends, when the Blessed One rose from his seat and went into his dwelling after giving a summary in brief without expounding the detailed meaning, that is, because as to the source of which perceptions and notions tinged by proliferations beset a man, if nothing is found there to delight in, welcome and hold on to, this is the end of the underlying tendency to lust, underlying tendency of aversion, underlying tendency of views, or the underlying tendency to doubt, underlying tendency to conceit. Actually, the conceit means a specific type of conceit. I am better, I am worse, or I am the same. Or the underlying tendency to desire for existence, for being anything, or the underlying tendency to ignorance. This is the end of resorting to rods and weapons of quarrels, brawls, disputes, recrimination, malice, and false speech. Here these evil, unwholesome states cease without remainder. I understand the detailed meaning of this summary to be thus. Now, friend, if you wish, go to the Blessed One and ask him about the meaning of this. As the Blessed One explains to you, so should you remember it. Now I'm going to point out, he says here, that this is the reason why these mental proliferations come, because we have sensory experience. In other words, if you see, then you will perceive, you have feelings, you will have thoughts, you will have proliferations. That's what the Buddha is saying, because he said the only way to overcome that is to have no I. It's basically he's saying, see no evil, hear no evil, speak no evil, but even taking that even further. He's saying that when you have an eye, when you have an ear, when you have a nose, a mouth, when you have a body, when you have a mind, you will have feelings, pleasant and unpleasant. Straight away, that overturns the very possibility of a heaven where you will live happily ever after. Impossible, says the Buddha. If you have sensory experience, you have to have the three types of feeling, pleasant, unpleasant, and neutral. You cannot have any place, it just cannot be, where you have entirely pleasant feelings forever and ever and ever. So the goal of Buddhism was never to find a happy ever after home. The only goal is when there's no eye, when there's no ear, when there's no nose, when there's no tongue, there's no feeling. Look at the last paragraph there, or last sentence on page 205. When there is no mind, no mind objects, no mind consciousness. That is a goal. Only then is it impossible to point out the manifestation of all these problems. The goal here is cessation. Da da da. Yeah. Okay. You're saying the sensory basis program inevitably, you can't sort of avoid it, things like the conceit, I am better, worse, or the same. I would actually point out that the not so much the sense of seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, and touching, but the sixth sense, the sense of mind, is a culprit in that case. And the reason I say that is, again, learning Pali is you notice that the word for mind, mano, mano is a word for mind. It's actually the old Sanskrit word, manas, is mano in Pali. And that is where we get mind from and mental from. It's a Sanskrit word, which see, in our Indo-Aryan languages, which is English is one of those group of languages, we have mind. It's exactly the same word. But there's another word which I noticed, which was manati. And literally, that when you take a noun, and just like in English, you know, you have like, it's a good word, like ground, and you're grounded. Or what's the word I used the other day? Void, and something is voided. You make a noun, a verb out of a noun. I forget what that is in actual grammar. But when you make a verb out of a noun, you know, he's sad and he's saddened. The way they do that in Pali is they lengthen the first vowel and they put an E on the end. Mano becomes manati. It literally does what the mind does. And that word is used to measure. Manati is measuring. So seeing that, what mind does, this is actually in the linguistics of Sanskrit. Mind is that which measures. It's a very, very powerful insight into what this mind actually is. It measures, it judges, it contrasts. When you have a mind, you'll always be measuring things. Measuring things into big or short, today or tomorrow, fast or slow, good, better or worse, or the same. Where is mind consciousness? That's where we measure things. That's why that when I noticed that and gave just a talk, it was actually, I think, the first time I gave a talk on this was in Thailand to some monks. And they said, wow, Ajahn Brahm, you've just given your version of the famous teaching of the third Zen patriarch, which is a famous Mahayana teaching, Zen teaching, which starts off, the way is easy for those without preferences. Some of you might remember that. And what do you mean with no preferences? And I said, look, enlightenment is easy when you don't measure. Because when you don't measure, when the mind doesn't work, then the mind turns off. Then the path happens. When you don't measure, you can't control. When you can't control, you're still. You don't do anything. So that measuring is part of the nature of the mind. So your answer to that question, I would say, the culprit there is not the other five senses, it's sense number six. That's where the conceit comes from. Measuring the other five, measuring itself, measuring everything, this is what it does. It's nature. And so the only way to stop that is to turn it off. That's a hard thing to do, because if you turn off the measuring mind, you disappear too. But there is something else I wanted to say on this one. Okay, But the Buddha also said here, what is not said here by Mahakachana is it says about bhikkhus, as the source of which perceptual notions seems by mental proliferation beset a man, if nothing is found there to delight in, welcome and hold on to, this is the end of the underlying tendency to lust, of the underlying tendency to aversion, and all these other problems. He's saying as long as there's nothing there to hold on to, delight in and welcome, then that's the end. So does it really mean as long as you don't hold on and delight to these things, then you will have no aversion, no problems anymore, no, say, proliferation, no thinking? And I remember years ago we asked Ajahn Chah that question, do arahats think? He said, of course they think. Do they proliferate? Of course they proliferate. He said, as long as you've got a mind, that's what a mind does. He's a very wise person. I remember we asked him once because somebody got bit by a rabid dog. And we asked him, he said, what would happen if an arahat, an enlightened being, got bit by a rabid dog? Would he go like screaming for water and acting in this crazy way? He said, of course they would. Even an enlightened being? Yeah, because this is just what the body does. It's nothing to do with the enlightened being or not. It's a great question and a brilliant answer. When we say nothing to delight in and welcome, what that really means is that when you understand what these things are, who would welcome them and delight in them? Why would you delight and welcome like the sense of seeing when it's going to cause you so much problem? When you can't control it, you can't just have pleasant sights, you can't just have pleasant sounds. You're old enough now, most of you are getting on a bit, more than a bit, many of you. And surely by now, you know you can't get pleasant feelings in the body. That's obvious to you. So if we only figured that out when we were young, we would delight in the body or delight in physical feelings and welcome them. Because they promised so much when you were young and they've never lived up to that promise. They're very deceitful, the five senses. Every now and again they promise if you just get this treatment, then you'll feel healthy and fit again. Ha 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 ha. If you just find that perfect partner, you know there's someone in there. This lady once came to me years ago. She was about 55 or something. She was still as stupid. She said, I know he's out there somewhere. I just haven't met him yet, my soulmate. Still. Looking like that. Oh no, I can't do that. I have to be honest. But anyhow, she asked if I could keep a straight face, and I said, no way. But when we don't welcome these things, the problems don't go away straight away. It's only when all the senses cease that the problems go away. So when it says, when there's nothing there to delight in, welcome and hold on to, this is the end. Really, in Pali, sometimes when they say this is the end, they mean it will be the end. I would actually put in there, to change the Pali into English, this is the beginning of the end of the underlying tendency to lust. The beginning of the end of the underlying tendency to aversion. The beginning of the end of the underlying tendency to views. And I have justification in this because this is one of the idioms of another language. We have a little bit of the same meaning, sort of, you know, if there is some sort of gangster movies where I used to watch when I was a kid, sometimes someone had cheated the boss of the gang, and the other friends would say, you're in big trouble now, mate, you're dead. He said, I'm not dead, I'm alive. But what he said, you're dead, meant it's absolutely certain you're going to die. And that's something which is very clear when you read the Dharma in Pali. If something is absolutely certain, like you're certainly, you know, you're going to be killed by the mafia boss because you've cheated them, you're dead. So when there's a certainty, sometimes a sense of timing is taken away. When there is nothing found there to delight in, welcome and hold on to, the end is certain. That's why it says, That is the end of the underlying tendency to lust, to aversion, underlying tendency to views, underlying tendency to doubt, underlying tendency to measuring oneself, underlying tendency to even desire for being. Understanding what being means, always has associated with these senses. That's what being is. Being a sensitive person and having to have pain and pleasure. Or the underlying tendency to ignorance. That's the end of resorting to rods and weapons, of quarrels, brawls, disputes, wars, recrimination, malice, and forced speech. Here, those evil, unwholesome states cease without remainder. I understand the detailed meaning of the summary to be thus. Now, friends, if you wish, go to the Blessed One and ask him about the meaning of this. As the Blessed One explains it to you, so should you remember it. So even an enlightened person thinks. Sometimes I remember asking Ajahn Chah, because I take him to be the standard, the enlightened being. And I remember asking him once, in the evening, once all the monks are gone, what do you do? Do you meditate? He said, oh, sometimes I meditate. Sometimes I think about the monastery, about his duties and how he can improve it. He was actually saying, yes, sometimes he does proliferate. His mind thinks, which is quite obvious. Even arahats think. Because that's what a mind does. And the only way to stop that proliferation is to stop the senses. That's what Mahakachana is saying here. You can't have senses and not think and proliferate. Basically, that's what sense does. Then the monks, having delighted and rejoiced in the venerable Mahakachana's words, rose from their seats and went to the Blessed One. After paying homage to him, they sat down on one side and told the Blessed One all that had taken place after he had left, adding, then the venerable sir went to the venerable Mahakachana and asked him about the meaning. The venerable Mahakachana expounded the meaning to us with these terms, statements, and phrases. So just basically checking the Mahakachana got it right. And the Buddha said, Mahakachana is wise, monks. Mahakachana has great wisdom. If you had asked me the meaning of this, I would have explained it to you in the same way that Mahakachana has explained it. Such is the meaning of this, and you should remember it then. Remember it so. And when this was said, the Venerable Ananda said to the Blessed One, Ah, oh, Venerable Sir, just as if... Well, you know, he was gushing because he loved the Buddha. You know, he had this amazing sort of emotional attachment to the Buddha. And one of the reasons he never got enlightened while the Buddha was alive. Very sweet. Venerable Sir, just as if a man exhausted by hunger and weakness would come upon a honey ball. They obviously liked honey balls in those days. If that was me, if that was in the time, if I was Ananda, I would say, just as if a man exhausted by hunger and weakness came upon a cup of tea. In the course of eating... He would be filled, he would find a sweet, delectable flavor. So too, Venerable Sir, any able-minded monk in the course of scrutinizing with wisdom the meaning of this discourse on the Dhamma would find satisfaction and confidence of mind. Venerable Sir, what is the name of this discourse on the Dhamma? As to that, Ananda, you may remember this discourse on the Dhamma as the Honeyball Sutta. So if that was me, it would have been named the Cup of Tea Sutta. But that was not to be. This is what the Blessed One said. Venerable Ananda was satisfied and delighted in the Blessed One's words. So that's my take on the Honeyball Sutta. All about stopping sensory experience. Yes. Yeah, of course you can ask questions. Where does delusion fit into all of this? Is delusion in the mind or is delusion in the eye or whatever? Is where delusion fits in. First of all, what is the particular type of delusion? The delusion is actually, first of all, well, that's many parts of delusion, is thinking that what is beautiful is really beautiful. That's why there's a saying there, what enlightened beings say is suffering, the world says is happiness. What the world says is suffering, the enlightened one says happiness. They've got the wrong way around. So what is really happiness? What really turns you on? What you think is happiness and pleasure, the enlightened ones say, no, that's suffering. Let's take sex. Is sex pleasurable? Dania? You just got married. I'm really cheeky. So, you know, why do people spend so much time messing around with sex? Because they really think it's pleasurable. And the Buddha said, no, it's painful. That's really radical. That's why we don't usually say that very often. That's, you're wrong. Buddhism is stupid saying that. No, check it out. Sometimes it's like the emperor's new clothes. Somebody comes along and says, the emperor's wearing no clothes, and they think they're stupid. And actually, they're right. Just because no one else says it doesn't mean it's wrong. What else is pleasurable? Seeing the birth of your first child. Watching your grandchildren grow up. Is that pleasurable? How many times you get a grandchild and people run off, they go over the overseas to go and visit their grandchildren. Oh, it's so wonderful. My daughter's had the first baby. I must go and see it and hold it. Oh, isn't it cute? People actually, I don't know why, but they sometimes, some of my disciples, when they have kids, they send me photographs of their babies. I'm a mug, for goodness sake. And they all say, oh, isn't it beautiful? And sometimes I break my precepts and say, oh, it's beautiful. You got no choice. But anyway, that's the first part of delusion. I'll finish off the delusion bit. Second part of delusion is thinking that you're in control of things. And that's an amazing delusion, that you really think you're in control. And how many times you've been frustrated and things haven't worked out, and you think it's your fault? It's none of your fault. It happens to everybody. And we all get frustrated and things don't go the way they should. Why is that? Isn't it sort of, there's nothing wrong with you. The system isn't broken. That's the way the system is. It's out of control. You're out of control. The kids are out of control. What do you expect? There's no one in here driving the bus. So when you're out of control, you can sit here and just shut up and let go. Because all your effort and trying is just counterproductive. It just makes you more tense. It adds to suffering. It doesn't take away suffering when you try and control the world. That's the second delusion, that you're the one in control. You can actually do something as long as you work harder. And the last one is the delusion that you are. That's the biggest one. That's really scary. What? It's obvious I am. Look, here I'm speaking. Ah, on the surface it may be, but you look more deeply. You think all that you took yourself to be vanishes and disappears. That couldn't have been me. You are just a process. You know that you knew. You take that to be evidence of self. When Descartes said, I think, therefore I am, that's wrong. He thought, therefore he thought again, that he was. Just because you think doesn't mean you are. Anyway, those are the big delusions. And where do they actually exist? They exist in your mind every time you think of them. Yeah, your question. There's someone who's, say, blind, deaf, and can't say like dumb because that's just the way we relate to the world. There was, people still do think. But the whole perceptual framework is different, which means that sometimes it's very hard for such people to relate to other beings. The perceptual framework of the world which they build up through their experiences is so dissimilar from people who do have those senses, that sometimes, literally, they are in a different world than the rest of people. However, if a person who has no sensory stimulus at all, you know, they can't see, they can't hear, taste, smell, if they can't even touch, they die. Because it's one thing which is said in the by the Buddha, some of the fuel, like a fuel for a car, or the fuel which makes electricity, the fuel which makes being has to be sensory experience. That's one of the great fuels. You don't have any sensory experience, just the body turns off. If you really couldn't see anything, and you couldn't hear, smell, taste, and you couldn't feel anything with the body, you would die. Not because of any disease, because basically the mind would have nothing to do with the body. So there's always value in things. The basic value is just to use those to explore the truth of the world. But there's a lot of delusion with sensory experience. But just the idea of like sensory experience is useful for living. What's the whole purpose of living? Just for its own sake? Why do you want to be? It's always a great question which no one actually asks. Why do you want to be? I'm not talking about some suicidal tendencies of destroying yourself. But what is this thing which always wants to exist and all control things? Sorry? Aha, that's an interesting thing. Love and compassion, what actually is that? That love and compassion is a desire to sort of end the suffering which you see in other beings. That particular type of love is a particular high which you can experience. And for many people it's the most pleasurable. I'm not talking about a romantic love, I'm talking about selfless love. And for many people that's the highest thing they know. But there is more than that. This is actually why the meditations, sometimes even in the first jhana, that if a Christian experiences that, they call it union with God. It's a union with love, just in the center of this incredible, powerful, blissful, pure love. And that's what many people experience it that way. Most love being the center of this loving universe. But that's only the first jhana. There's things beyond that. When you know what's beyond love is peace. So love is not the end. It's high. It's probably the highest peak which most human beings know, the selfless love. But there's more. These teachings of Buddhism are radical. We're not demeaning love. We're saying there's more to it yet. Da, da, da. Yeah, go on. Did the Buddha say that through sensation you gain insight and value? He said, no, the Buddha actually said, this is a very common saying by the Buddha, it's only through stillness you gain insights. The Pali is samadhi paccaya yata bhuta yana dasana. Only through the still states of mind which you gain in the deepest meditations do you see things as they truly are. There always are Buddhist groups, all sorts of groups who say that. I think what you're talking about is a particular type of vipassana tradition, which was very much promoted by some Burmese monks, who say you don't need to get still states of mind, who actually teach that samatha, stilling the mind, is dangerous. And that is completely against the teachings of the Buddha. Have a look at yourself in the teachings of the Buddha and you come across the still states of mind, the jhanas again and again and again. Things like in the Gopika Moggallana Sutta. I'll even get it out for you here. Just trying to take a couple of minutes while I'm If I can remember, it is 100 and... no, I won't be able to find it now. Gopika Mogalana Sutta, 100 and something. There the Buddha actually... Well, actually, it wasn't the Buddha, actually. It was Venerable Ananda was asked after the Buddha. Here we go. It's on page 885, Sutta 108, where somebody asked Master Ananda after the Buddha passed away, and what kind of meditation did the Blessed One praise? Here, Brahmin, quite secluded from sensual pleasures, secluded from unwholesome states, the monk enters upon and abides in the first jhana, the second jhana, the third jhana, the fourth jhana. The Blessed One prays that kind of meditation. The jhana states. So anyone who says those jhanas are dangerous is completely going against what the word of the Buddha said. These are the only ones the Buddha praised, because that's the stillness of the mind. That's the samadhi, the eighth factor of the Eightfold Path, where people see things as they truly are, in the deep, deep stillness of the mind. Yeah? Okay, oh, I haven't got it here. This is in the Dīgha Nikāya. In the Pasādika Sutta, the Buddha said, if any person says that, oh, you monks who enjoy the pleasures of the jhanas will become attached to them, and they use the word anuyoga, not the usual word for attachment, but anuyoga literally means attached. It means yoked along with. And they use that word if there was a cart with two oxen in the front. Those oxen would be tied to each other, anuyoga. That's a great word for attachment. So in that particular sutta, it's in the Pasādika Sutta of the Dīgha Nikāya. You can read it for yourself. It's in the long discourses of the Buddha. There the Buddha said that if any people come along and say, oh, you just get attached to the pleasures of the four jhanas. And the Buddha said, yes, but anyone who gets attached to the pleasures of the four jhanas can expect only one of four things. This is what happens when you get attached to the four jhanas. You can expect stream winning, once returning, non-returning, or full enlightenment. So that's the only four things you can expect if you attach to the bliss of the jhanas. Sorry? This is four jhanas. This is what happens if you get attached to the bliss of deep meditation, of the four jhanas. You can expect to be a stream winner, a once-returner, non-returner, or full enlightenment. That's the four stages of enlightenment. That's what people are supposed to be meditating for, to become enlightened, and there are four stages of enlightenment. That's straight from the Pasādika Sutta, the word of the Buddha. And the way you understand it, anyone who's actually experienced those jhanas, you know what they're like from experience. You haven't experienced them, it's just, you know, it's talking about things you don't know about. And if you experience those things, these aren't sort of places you get attached, in the sense of attached to worldly things, because these are deep states of letting go. You don't get to these stages by trying and forcing the mind. This is when you really let go of control, you really let things be big time. And there's stages of letting go. The more you let go, the deeper into stillness you get. So staying, you're going to get attached, and it's a problem, is actually discouraging people from becoming enlightened. Yeah? Yeah. Ah. The danger is a stage of wanting, and that's quite common that a person who attains any of these jhanas, the first time, because so often you have to teach people who have got a jhana first and spent a long time, but then you say, look, how did those jhanas come about? You can't get them by wanting. You aspire to them through letting go. You have to let go. That's the only way they exist. So you don't discourage them and say they are dangerous. They are part of the path. They're an essential part of the path. There's no enlightenment without them. That's very, very clear. But it's how to get them. They are stages of letting go. And you can't achieve a state of letting go by wanting or by controlling. Okay, you're talking about some of the things you have aversion towards, some of the things you have desire for, some of the things you react to. It's very helpful to understand those things, but it's still superficial. You're not going deep enough into how the mind works and what the mind is. People who practice just to that level will not get enlightened. They'll have a little bit more peace in their world, but even that peace won't last. I haven't gone deep enough to get deeper under the subtle defilements, the defilement of being and controlling and thinking that you are in charge of these things. This is just the simile which I gave. It's the simile of like a lake. Yeah, you can see the lake and the waves going up and going down on the surface of the lake, but that's not anicca, that's not impermanence. That's superficial impermanence. There comes a time when the whole lake vanishes. When things which were always there, for as long as you've known, are no longer there. And that shocks you to the core. It's the surface on which those pleasures and pains are played out. They vanish. That's what anicca means. Nietzsche means something permanent, always been there. So much you never noticed it. Now it completely goes. And then you realize it's not just the pleasure and the pain of the body or any other sensations. It's the very fabric on which those things exist has disappeared. And that's the powerful fading away of things which makes people enlightened. That's why the Buddha taught in this way. So you have to check the Buddha's teachings. That's why he kept on and on and on about jhana, 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 jhana. Check it out. Don't just believe Ajahn Brahm. Don't just believe any monk or any teacher. See what the Buddha said. Okay, sometimes you're saying that you're having a conversation and sometimes you're there and sometimes you're not there. If this is a state of mind and sometimes these things are just so hard to describe, if I understand you correctly, it is almost as if there's a sense of you has just dissolved and disassociated with the experience. And you know there's so many different levels of identification of a me and an I in what we're experiencing. And part of that has completely disappeared when you're listening to me. So part of you has gone. There's lots more to go yet. As many of these experiences are great, yeah? You can only do it through the meditation, through meditative practice, absolutely, yes. You can't just think your way through. That's why, I know this is sometimes a controversy, but just please look at what the Buddha taught. Don't trust any monk. Look at what the Buddha taught. And there you will actually see that there's an eightfold path. Not a sevenfold path, an eightfold path. A number eight. Not just once, not 100 times, they haven't counted it. Lots and lots of times, the eighth factor, Samma Samadhi, is usually translated as right concentration, but I prefer right stillness. It's more evocative of what the word means. This eighth factor of the Eightfold Path is always first jhana, second jhana, third jhana, fourth jhana. Nothing else. It's always that. I just mentioned the only meditation the Buddha praises is first jhana, second jhana, third jhana, fourth jhana. One of the clearest ones is in the Mahamalunkya Putra Sutta, and that's number 64 in the Majjhima Nikaya in here. So you can't get enlightened without a jhana. He said, you can't do that without a jhana, no more than you can reach the heartwood of a tree without going through the bark and sapwood. Very, very clear. And there's other places in the Anguttara Nikaya. The Buddha says that without Samma Samadhi, which is always jhana, you can't fulfill wisdom. Insight can't happen without it. And check it out. That's what the Buddha taught. And if you get into a jhana, you get into those deep stillness, you'll understand for yourself why the Buddha taught that way. Okay, so this is supposed to be on the Honeyball Sutta. So I hope you thought it was nice and sweet and enjoyed it. And see what happens next time. So let's just pay respects to the Buddha, Dhamma, and Sangha, and then we can go off to our various destinations.
Arahaṃ sammāsambuddho bhagavā buddhaṃ bhagavantaṃ abhivādhemi suvākkhato bhagavata dhammo dhammaṃ namassāmi Supatipanno bhagavato savaka sangho sankhang namami